Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we review some recent developments in the public safety labor relations world. I'm going to dive right into the cases this month because we've got a bunch of them and they're pretty significant. I can think of no better place to start than in California, where the long-awaited Supreme Court decision, California Supreme Court decision, about the extent to which retirement benefits can be modified has finally been released. This is the so-called Cal Fire case. Why is it long-awaited? It's long-awaited because there's been a thrust among employers and also the state of California to get a case to the California Supreme Court so it could re-examine what's come to be known as the California rule. What's the California rule? The California rule is that if a pension benefit is vested, if the employee has put in whatever the requisite amount of service is in order to vest in the pension system, then the pension benefit cannot be reduced in one area unless there is a corresponding and roughly equal benefit increase in another area. So what we're looking at is kind of, is the net pension benefit the same as or better than it was before? California rule has been around for decades. It comes to us courtesy of a California Supreme Court decision, but has been under tremendous attack as many pension systems in California, most notably the state PERS system, are fairly woefully underfunded. So what's the case that made it up to the Supreme Court, and what did the court do with it? And by the way, I'll give you a little bit of a advance notice. The court ducked the most important issue in the case, as courts are sometimes want to do. All right, so what's the case about? This case, which is, as I mentioned, goes by the name of Cal Fire, which is a local of the International Association of Firefighters. This case focuses on something that is known as airtime. So airtime is a way of capturing the ability of members of the CalPERS system to purchase additional retirement system credits. So as you get close to retirement, the CalPERS system will tell you what these credits cost. If the employee pays for them, then they get additional years of service that go into the eventual pension formula without actually having to work that time. These credits, additional retirement systems credits, because they're untethered to actual service, those credits have acquired the nickname airtime. Well, in late 2012, the California pension systems were really groaning under the weight of a significant unfunded liability. And the California legislature sprung into action and enacted what's known as the California Public Employees Pension Reform Act of 2013, known more commonly by the acronym of PEPRA. PEPRA made a lot of changes in the pension systems that were legal and those that weren't legal, and how they would be funded, just an awful lot of changes in the California PERS system. And one of them was that PEPRA eliminated airtime. So when that happened, litigation started, and this Cal Fire case is the first one that made its way to the Supreme Court on the issue of the elimination of airtime. What's the legal issue that the court has to decide? Pension benefits have long been thought to be either an explicit or an implied contract between the employee on one hand and on the other hand, the pension system, in this case, the state. That's an implied contract where on one hand, the employee puts in the work in the anticipation of receiving a future pension, and on the other hand, the employer, the state, the pension system, the citizens get the value of the work. So it's a promise. If you do this work now, we're going to defer part of your compensation in the form of a pension, and we'll pay you the pension once you're all done with the work. That is thought to be a contract. And because that is a contract, it is covered by what's known as the Contracts Clause. That exists in many state constitutions, but also preeminently in the United States Constitution. What does the Contracts Clause say? The Contracts Clause says that the government may not interfere with existing contracts. And over time, we've had a slug of pension reform cases from around the country that test whether or not a particular pension benefit is a contract, and if so, whether the Contracts Clause of either the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution, whether the Contracts Clause protects employees such that the employer may not unilaterally, or the pension system may not unilaterally, reduce pension benefits. And that's the issue that's going up to the California Supreme Court in the Cal Fire case. Is airtime protected by the Contracts Clause of the Constitution? And if so, should we get rid of the California rule? Should we say, as a court of appeals in California has recently said, when we started the California rule, we didn't really mean what we said. We didn't really mean that every reduction in benefits has to be offset by a benefit increase somewhere else in the package. As the Court of Appeals said, what we really meant was you can have reductions in benefits so long as the pension benefit that is left is a reasonable pension benefit. So that's the sort of analysis that employers and the state were urging the California Supreme Court to enter into in the Cal Fire case. And the court said, nope, cart before the horse. We're going to take these issues as they logically present themselves. Is airtime a protected contractual benefit? And if so, what do we do about the California rule? Do we keep going with it? Do we amend it? Do we discard it? What do we do? And the court right up front says, we're not going to even touch the California rule. And the reason we're not going to touch it is because we don't think airtime is constitutionally protected. It's not a contract. So let me read you the three most important sentences in the court's opinion on the California rule. And that's the big issue here, right? It's not airtime. Airtime's just one benefit among many. The California rule could potentially impact all benefits in a pension system. And when I read these three sentences, I want you to listen very, very carefully to what the court has to say, because I think there's a hint in these sentences as to the continued vitality of the California rule. Here we go. The state and many amici, that means that's Latin for friends of the court, amicus curiae brief. The state and many amici urge us to use this decision as a vehicle to reduce the protection afforded pension rights by modifying or abandoning the California rule. Because we conclude that the opportunity to purchase airtime was not a term and condition of public employment protected from impairment by the contract clause, its elimination does not implicate the Constitution. For that reason, we have no occasion in this decision to address, here comes the most important words, let alone to alter, the continued application of the California rule. In other words, the Supreme Court says, we're not touching the California rule. We don't have to. We're not going to touch it. We have no reason to alter it. What I found so striking about, in particular, that last sentence, and by the way, when you're reading these court's opinions, understand that the judges who are joining in this opinion They are having conference after conference to talk about draft opinions, making suggestions, doing redrafts and everything like that. Believe me, I spent 2 years clerking for a court of appeals. Believe me when I say that courts choose individual words carefully. They're not incautious when they write things. And what the court is saying here is, we have no occasion to address, let alone alter. I suspect that is a hint that the court is going to keep the California rule alive. Maybe not. Maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into the tea leaves here. But there was no reason for the court to write those four words, let alone to alter, unless maybe a majority of those judges on the court aren't ready to ever alter the California rule. The issue will come back before the court, right? And it will come back before the court eventually in a form where whatever the underlying pension benefit is very clearly a contractually protected benefit. And then the court's going to have to address the California rule. But for now, employees all over California, public employees, are breathing a little bit easier. For now, public employers that are paying the lion's share of these pension contributions and the state that's on the hook for the pension system, public employers in the state are grinding their teeth saying, we thought we had this one set up. We thought this was going to be the case. It turns out it's not. They're going to have to direct their resources elsewhere. So why was airtime not a contractually protected benefit? And the answer that the court said is that when the legislature allowed airtime for the first time, when it made that an option, that employees could choose or not choose at the end, we don't find that a contract was created. So, once again, let me go back to the court's opinion, read you a couple of sentences so you see what the court's rationale was. Here's the court. It's critical, in order to have a contracts clause violation, that the legislative enactment upon which the implied contractual rights were premised was a resolution approving an express contract of employment. Nothing of the sort happened with respect to airtime. The legislature did not engage in any sort of negotiations with public employees who were covered by airtime, let alone ratify an express or implied contract reflecting its terms. The legislature simply enacted a statute granting the opportunity to purchase airtime credits. Those types of statutes, the court says, announce a policy. They don't create a contract. And that's not the clearest sort of legal analysis that one has ever seen. One could argue that an employee took their job in California on the premise, in part, that there would be this ability to purchase airtime down the road, that they provided all this service to their employer and to the citizens of the state. One could argue that, but the court's ruling here is not entirely implausible. The court is, I think, drawing a distinction between pension benefits and the ability at the end of your career to purchase additional pension benefits. Pension benefits, you earn, and you earn as you provide service. The ability to purchase the pension benefits, that doesn't spring into action until you're eligible to do it towards the end of your career. So I think that's the distinction the court is raising. Bottom line, this is a case that, as sometimes people describe spring, it came in as a lion. Everybody expected this was going to be a huge, huge decision, and went out as a lamb. It went out kind of meekly. And we'll have to wait for another day the resolution of the most important issue, the continued vitality of the California rule. All right, I'm going to stay in California for our next case, a completely different subject matter this time, and it raises a question that you see come up with some regularity. Does the exclusionary rule apply in disciplinary appeals? The exclusionary rule with which we're so familiar in a criminal setting, right? If you have an illegal search or seizure, then evidence cannot be submitted without the violation of the individual's constitutional rights. We're very familiar with it in a criminal setting. Does it apply in disciplinary cases? So this case involves a corrections officer, a fellow named Ernesto Ramirez, and he works for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. In December of 2011, Ramirez attends a get-together at the home of another corrections officer, a guy named Jorge Molina. At the get-together, Ramirez is in possession of his off-duty firearm at the same time that he's drinking. That, by the way, is against department policy. Ramirez compounds the problem a bit by passing his firearm around the party so the other guests in the house can take a look at and handle the firearm. Ramirez then later drives himself and Molina to a local bar where, problem number two, they consume a pitcher of beer. Ramirez had his off-duty firearm with him in the bar. That's another problem. Around 1:30 a.m., Ramirez encounters another problem. He gets into a verbal altercation with a group of men. Another problem coming up. He then identifies himself as a peace officer and displays his badge. Remember, he's a corrections officer. And he also told the group of men that he had a firearm with him, and he was not afraid to use it. The security guard in the bar tells everyone to leave, starts to clear out the bar. Some of the patrons say, no, we're not going to go, and somebody calls the local police. So Ramirez, Molina, and three other guys all leave the bar in Ramirez's vehicle. Ramirez is driving. Remember the pitcher of beer and all that sort of stuff. A Merced police officer, City of Merced police officer, that's going to become important here, arrives on the scene to follow up on the request for help. He sees Ramirez driving and arrests him for driving under the influence of alcohol. Ramirez is prosecuted, and in the prosecution, he files a successful motion to suppress the evidence from his detention and arrest, and basically says there wasn't probable cause and et cetera, et cetera. And so the criminal proceedings are dropped, but not the department proceedings. The department fires Ramirez for using his status as a correctional officer to try to gain favor with the local police department during the stop. Ramirez badged the City of Merced police officer. Secondly, violating department policy by carrying a concealed weapon while off duty, while intoxicated or drinking. And third, lying in his disciplinary interview. The department's decision to fire Ramirez is upheld through the administrative process, and Ramirez files a challenge in the California Court of Appeals and says, you can't fire me because you can't consider the evidence that was accrued after I was stopped by the Merced police officer. That's all barred by the exclusionary rule. It's just as unconstitutional, says Ramirez, to use illegally seized evidence in an administrative proceeding as it is in a criminal proceeding. And the Court of Appeals in California says, you're wrong, Ramirez. The exclusionary rule is, and a quote, rarely applied in civil actions unless there's some sort of statute that controls the whole situation. The exclusionary rule is extended only to civil proceedings if they're so closely identified with the criminal prosecution such that the civil proceedings are really quasi-criminal in nature. And that's not what we have here. We have two entirely different types of cases, a disciplinary case and a criminal prosecution. Now, here comes the heart of the court's opinion. It's about two or three sentences. Let me read it to you. Application of the exclusionary rule must serve to advance the purpose of the rule, i.e., to deter the constitutional violation at issue. Here, punishing the corrections department in the administrative disciplinary proceeding by excluding evidence from the illegal detention at the scene will not deter the Merced police from future unlawful detentions. The focus of the deterrence must be on the actor who committed the Fourth Amendment violation. In this case, the police officer, the Merced police officer. And the court said when the police officer first detained Ramirez, which was an illegal detention, he didn't know Ramirez was a corrections officer. And thus, he couldn't have any possible anticipation that the evidence from the detention would be used in an administrative disciplinary proceeding. Back to the court's opinion, we conclude that the bungling police officer, you just know they had to be waiting to write that, right? We conclude that the bungling police officer is not likely to be halted by the thought that his unlawful conduct will prevent the termination of employment. How does this decision by the court square with decisions in other states and also decisions by arbitrators who are asked to consider evidence that may have been excluded from criminal proceedings? This is very clearly the majority rule, that the exclusionary rule does not apply in disciplinary appeals. There's a few exceptions out there, but by and large, virtually every court or arbitrator or civil service board that has looked at the issue has taken very much the same approach. Why should we apply the exclusionary rule where the purpose of the exclusionary rule is deterring illegal conduct on the part of law enforcement? Why should we apply it in a setting where there will be no deterrence, where the law enforcement agency simply doesn't care what happens to this guy's job, or may not have even, as in Ramirez's case, known that he was a public safety employee? So this is it's a case or an issue that recurs with some regularity out there, but there's not much controversy as to how the case comes out. Next up, I want to give you a post-Janus update. What's going on with all of the litigation out there around the country in the wake of Janus? There's been a series of lawsuits filed around the country. Pretty much they're all being backed by the same group of Koch brothers-supported nonprofits, most prominently the Right to Work Foundation in Virginia. The lawsuits are attempting to, in some cases, nibble around the edges to expand what Janus held, and in some cases, just simply are attacking the existence of labor organizations. So we've seen, by my count, six major decisions around the country involving Janus since the Janus decision was rendered by the Supreme Court in June of 2018. And so far, these nonprofits like the Right to Work Foundation are 0 for 6. They've lost all of the cases. And the most important of the cases that we've seen so far, there's one case where we had an argument that if somebody signed a dues deduction card before Janus, that dues deduction card is invalid, even if they chose to voluntarily be a full member of the labor organization. Why would it be invalid? It would be invalid because at the time of the signing of the dues deduction card, that individual may not have known that the only other alternative to signing it becoming a fair share member, was going to be declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in Janus. Courts that have looked at that have said, no, that's wrong. Fair share was constitutional until Janus. It had been constitutional for 41 years, courtesy of a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court in the Abood versus City of Detroit case. So those dues deduction cards are perfectly legal and enforceable, and you don't need to go out and make all employees sign new dues deduction cards. There's another case out there where an employee signed a dues deduction card saying, I want to be a full member, and the dues deduction agreement had a one-year duration. So it said the employee consented to the deduction of dues for 12 months. And after Janus came down, the argument was, well, that can't be legal anymore after Janus because now employees have the right not to be members of a labor organization. And the court hearing that case said, no, that's not right either, because when you sign that sort of 12-month dues deduction, you're entering into that voluntarily. You didn't say you wanted to be a fair share member. You said you wanted to be a full member, and you wanted to do so for 12 months. That's a contract. And over the course of that 12 months, the union may have already provided all sorts of services to you where you've already gotten value for your end of the bargain. Now you need to live up to the remainder of your end of the bargain by paying dues for the end of the term. Do we know how long dues deduction consents could potentially be viable? This court approved it up to a year. We don't know yet. That's going to be tested. I am guessing it's not going to be open-ended for the rest of my career, but I am guessing that a duration of more than 1 year will be enforceable. Because of the notion of voluntary contract. I would expect that a dues deduction card for the term of a collective bargaining agreement would easily be constitutional because of the services that the union would be providing. But I'm guessing that once you get to more than 3 years, 4 or 5 years, courts are going to have a hard time swallowing that length of a dues deduction period. Now, the case I wanted to talk to you about that just came down last month, this is from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out on the West Coast, and it involves not a public safety union, it involves the Service Employees International Union, local 925, that is the exclusive bargaining representative for Washington's publicly subsidized child care providers. And so Local 925 has members. They're essentially kind of quasi-private citizens, but they're providing individual child care, has these members all over the state. Two of them, aided by the Right to Work Foundation, filed a lawsuit. And the basis of the lawsuit, after Janus, any state bargaining law that attempts to provide for exclusive bargaining representatives is unconstitutional. That's what the argument is. And there is some language, a little bit of language in the Janus opinion itself that tends to support that argument. So what's the language in the Janus opinion itself? Here's a quote from Janus. It is also not disputed that the state may require that a union serve as exclusive bargaining agent for its employees, itself a significant impingement on associational freedoms that would not be tolerated in other contexts. So the Right to Work Foundation is looking at that language and saying, aha, what the court really wanted to do in Janus was to strike down the ability of unions to serve as exclusive bargaining agents, But that issue wasn't presented squarely in Janus. It was just the fair share decision. And now we're squarely presenting that issue. And we think that what the Supreme Court would be saying here is that exclusive bargaining representative status is not constitutional. Ninth Circuit wasn't buying it. And here's the Ninth Circuit's analysis of the whole issue. The court says, in this passage, the one I just read you, Janus suggested that exclusive bargaining representation does significantly impinge on associational freedoms. But in the same breath, the court stated that this degree of impingement is justified or tolerated in the context of collective bargaining agents. Janus explained, said the court, that states can keep their labor relations systems exactly as they are. They just cannot force non-members to subsidize public sector unions. And then the court puts a bow on the wrapping of this particular package by saying also in Janus, the Supreme Court expressly distinguished between compelling non-union members to pay agency fees, constitutionally impermissible, and mandating that any union representation be exclusive, which the court suggested is a tolerated impingement of non-union members' First Amendment rights. Now, translation of all that, what is the Ninth Circuit saying? You made your argument in the wrong court. You want to attack this issue of exclusive bargaining or representative status? You got to do that before the Supreme Court, because right now the state of the law is that Janus seemingly blessed exclusive representation status. I'll put a footnote on this. The court didn't actually talk about this, but I'll put a footnote on this that you might want to think about. So what happens if the Right to Work Foundation and these two employees, what happens if they'd actually won this case? That would mean that the state of Washington or any other employer potentially might end up with a whole lot of collective bargaining agreements, right? You might have competing unions that come in that say, hey, we want to be representing these employees. And if you don't have exclusive representation, then you could have competing unions. You could even have individuals demanding their own collective bargaining agreements. In short, you'd have chaos. And that's the ultimate aim here of the Right to Work Foundation. I mean, they're not stopping with the issue of fair share. That's never really even been their primary issue. Their big issue is they want public sector unions gone. And so this spate of litigation that we're seeing right now is just setting us up for the next big confrontation before the U.S. Supreme Court about the constitutionality of public unionization systems. And that's not good news for those of you in labor unions out there, because right now there seems to be five judges on the Supreme Court who are pretty hostile to public sector labor unions. The next case I want to talk about is a case from Pennsylvania dealing with anti-union bias, or as it's sometimes called, a technical term is anti-union animus. These are strange cases, and they're strange cases because they usually involve discipline of somebody who is a union official, and the employer is saying, we discipline them because of misconduct, and the union is saying, oh no, you discipline them because of their union affiliation or their union activities. And what's strange about them is not that you have those competing accounts of what's going on, but what's strange is that usually, almost always, the employee has in fact engaged in some misconduct. That is a given. And what the focus of the case is not the misconduct, but rather the employer's motivation in choosing the particular disciplinary sanction that it chooses. Why'd you come down hard on this guy when you didn't come down as hard on all those other people. So let's talk about this. Let's dive into this case in Lawrence County, Pennsylvania, and I'll show you how these cases are analyzed and why this is just a, this is really a great case factually for illustrating the principles behind these anti-union bias cases. The centerpiece of our story is Kevin Boston, a corrections officer. He's instrumental in this bargaining unit affiliating with Local 261 of the Teamsters Union. They had been represented in the past by the Laborers Union. The Laborers Union got tired of them, did what's called disclaim interest. This is where a union notifies the labor board, we're not representing these people anymore. They disclaimed interest in the bargaining unit in January of 2017, and the Teamsters, Local 261, came in. Boston was instrumental in getting the bargaining unit to join Local 261, and he served on Local 261's bargaining team. So they're bargaining in 2017, and it's not going well. And impasse is declared, and the parties are headed to interest arbitration over their first contract. That's when the action starts. Boston gets summoned to a meeting. And the meeting has three people in it: the chair of what's known as the county's prison board, that's sort of a governing body for the prison system, the warden, and a county attorney. The county attorney asked Boston, and I'm quoting, "Have you ever called anyone in the jail a bitch?" Boston responds that he has. The county attorney then asked, "Have you ever said the deputy warden's penis has been in anyone's mouth?" Boston starts to realize that something is up now and says, "I want an attorney." The chair of the prison board says, and I'm quoting, "Go get a fucking attorney and we'll fucking start this." Boston leaves the meeting and then goes back to the jail, where he encounters a maintenance worker, one Billy Grannis. Boston takes Grannis into the men's bathroom at the jail for privacy and asks Grannis, "Are you the one who filed the charge against me?" Grannis says, "I was forced to by the deputy warden and the warden. I don't want to mess with your family." You can see where this is going, and very shortly, Boston is fired by the department, and he's fired for, among other things, the use of profanity and sexual allusions, and also the exchange in the men's room with Grannis. The Teamsters Union, Local 261, then responds to the firing by filing an unfair labor practice, alleging that the true basis for Boston's discipline is anti-union bias. You can see the administrative law judge who handles this case, you can see how the normal sort of progression of these cases plays out in the ALJ's opinion. The ALJ says, look, and I'm quoting, and this is actually something that we teach in our seminars time and time again, using almost precisely the same words. The ALJ says, because direct evidence of anti-union animus is rarely presented or admitted by the employer, the labor board and its examiners can infer animus from evidence in the record. So what sort of evidence do you look at to get some sort of implication of anti-union bias? There's a list, the entire background of the case, including any anti-union activities or statements by the employer, the failure of the employer to adequately explain its actions, the discipline that it took against the adversely impacted employee, the effect of the adverse action on other employees and protected activities, the employer's pattern of discipline in similar cases, and whether or not the action that the employer took was, and I'm quoting here, inherently destructive of employee rights. The ALJ then turns to the facts in this case and says, well, first of all, it's clear Boston was engaged in all sorts of protected activity. You know, he's basically the ringleader for the Teamsters coming in, and he sits on the bargaining team, and he was the most visible presence in this local union. He was also a shop steward, and he engaged in all sorts of protected activities of a shop steward. So there's absolutely no question that Boston is engaged in protected activity. So now, what about the employer's motivation? What can we tell from the record in this case, the ALJ says, about whether the employer was motivated by a legitimate disciplinary reason or whether it was motivated by anti-union animus? And the ALJ says the record here supports an inference of anti-union animus for three different reasons, and any of the three are sufficient as a support for the anti-union animus. What are the reasons? One, the county engaged in disparate treatment with respect to the level of discipline that it gave to employees who engaged in these sorts of activities. Second, the county failed to explain the reason that it chose termination in this case. And third, other anti-union activities by the county that demonstrated its state of mind. Now I'm going to read you a few sentences from the ALJ's opinion that I think are the key sentences. And I'm quoting, "The county's disparate treatment of Boston leaps from the record. Witness after witness credibly testified that no other bargaining unit member or other jail employee had ever been disciplined for profane or lewd comments. No one could remember anyone ever receiving even a verbal warning. The use of profane and lewd language by employees had been rife in the county jail and suffused the employee's daily experience." I like the way this ALJ writes. I like the use of words. Back to the ALJ's opinion. "Tied to the analysis of disparate treatment is the county's failure to follow progressive discipline. The county did, in fact, have a policy on sexual harassment, but to the extent it had one, it's inconsistent with respect to discipline, and the county didn't consult it anyway when they decided to terminate Boston. I find," said the ALJ, "that the county's reasons for terminating Boston are pretextual due to the disparate treatment in the application of discipline to Boston, due to the county failing to have and enforce a consistent sexual harassment discipline policy, and the failure to consider and apply progressive discipline." What's the remedy in these sorts of cases? You undo the harm. And by undoing the harm here, it is that Boston is reinstated with full back pay. Now, there's a key fact in this case. The ALJ doesn't really harp on it at all, but I can tell you that as someone who's tried these sorts of cases, I can tell you this fact just leaped off the page, the electronic pages of this opinion when I read it. Remember, one of the reasons, the most important reason, that Boston is terminated is for the use of profanity. Go back to that meeting between Boston and the chair of the prison board, the warden, and the county attorney. How did that meeting end? Remember I told you the chair of the prison board responded, "Go get a fucking attorney and we'll fucking start this." Boston is fired for doing exactly what the chair of the prison board did to Boston. That fact is going to be really critical in one of these anti-union bias cases. By the way, just as an observation, the frequency of these cases, these anti-union bias cases, seems to come and go over time. There are times when you just don't see one of them for months and months, and sometimes even years on end. At other times where you see two or three or four of them a month from various places around the country. We're in one of those peak periods right now where I'm seeing a lot of these cases. That's why I thought it'd be a good idea to describe how these cases are analyzed by labor boards. With that, that's the conclusion of our First Thursday podcast for April of 2019. Remember, we've got the premium podcast series out there. I just finished doing an interview with a police chief, Chief Jim Porter of the Bend, Oregon Police Department, that I am already thinking is perhaps the most important podcast we have ever done. It is a podcast that will be incredibly important, I think, to police fire managers, police chiefs, fire chiefs, sheriffs, and the like, and will be just as incredibly important to rank-and-file individuals and labor organizations. There's change that's happened in the Bend Police Department that Chief Porter describes, and it is change that has profoundly turned around that agency. And it's change, I think, that all public safety agencies need to be considering. At any rate, if you're a premium podcast subscriber, we will probably put that one up sometime either in late April or in May. So with that, thanks for joining me. This is Will Aitchison on behalf of Labor Relations Information System signing off.